Morning.
Morning. So, good to see you guys. Just kidding. Anyway, good to see you guys. Welcome to Motion. If this is not your home church and this is your first time here, I am not the pastor. That is why I'm in jeans and a t-shirt, because that is what I wear every day, and I'm not the pastor. So if you don't like it, you know, I'm not the pastor. If you do like it, I'll be here next week, not teaching those, so we can talk about jeans and t-shirts. Anyway, that's our pastor over there. If anything I say this morning rubs you the wrong way, talk to him. He's the one that let me do this. Ultimately, it all lies on him, so I've got free reign and nothing to lose. So anyway, no, I do get to talk maybe once a year up here. I kind of like it. Kind of makes me nervous because I don't get to do it a whole lot. But I'm glad you came, and I think he kind of set me up for failure. There's like half of our normal crowd that's normally here, so I don't know if he just like sent out an email to make me look bad or something, so he'll look awesome next week when everyone shows up. Appreciate that one. But anyway, it's all good. Quick story. Just this has absolutely nothing to do with what I'm going to talk about. But you guys know that I absolutely despise summer with all that's within me. I really don't know if I can think of anything I hate more than summer. It just hurts outside. And I've got a car that typically has AC. Every day it's got AC. Until last Tuesday, this past Tuesday, which was also the hottest day in 4 years. I'm driving home from work. It's, who knows how hot. I don't think thermometers go that high out here. But it was hot, right? And like 10 minutes into my drive, I've got like a 40-minute drive. 10 minutes into it, my AC just stops working. I'm like, start kind of pressing buttons and whatnot, and nothing happens. So I roll down my windows, and I'm just angry, really, just to be honest. I'm just bitter at the world. I hate everything at that point. And so I think my AC's out, and that's that. It has worked ever since then. Like, that night, some cold front came through and brought it down to a comfortable 101, and it's fine now. And my AC suddenly works. I'm like, anyway, so my point there is that I hated that. So that I know that's profound. Take that for what you want. So if you hate summer with me, we can all rejoice. And if you like summer, I hope I brought you down a little bit off of your summer high, because it's not worth it. So anyway, now we'll get down to the real stuff. So I'm doing a teaching this morning. Obviously, we'll get into that. One thing, if you've got, I know nobody ever actually has a paper Bible, but if you've got some sort of technology that has Bibles on it, go ahead and get that if you want. We'll also have the verses on the screen. We're going to read through a pretty lengthy passage. Try to stick with me. I get that that is not necessarily proper teaching etiquette. You don't want to have people reading too much, but it's a really cool story. It's one of the weirdest stories in the entire Bible, in my opinion, and we'll see why as we get into it. We're going to be reading out of the Message. Before you jump on the whole, the Message isn't a real version sort of thing, I agree with you completely. I truly do. But I've read this story in like 4 different versions, and it changes really not much at all. So if it makes you nervous, read it out of whatever version you want, and I promise you it's not going to change much. That is that. So yeah, that's all the business end. We'll go into it. So this teaching, before we jump in, is going to be for all of us who are uncomfortable with certain aspects of Christianity. And it's weird because this one story ties together so many things, and that's why I love it, because I often, even before I say this, I'm going to make a disclaimer. I tend to be a pretty honest person about things. I don't like to pretend I'm better or higher than what maybe somebody on stage should be. Again, I'm not the pastor, so back off. But I'm going to be pretty honest about some stuff, so that's good. For most of us, if you don't like honesty, church is probably not the best place for you anyway. I don't know. But anyway, this story is a story for people who are uncomfortable with aspects of following Christ. There's aspects that this story will tie together when it comes to sharing your faith, in my opinion. There's aspects in this story that relate to how we relate to God, not only to others, but to God. And there's aspects in this story of how God feels about us, I think, all in one story. So we're going to read through it. Stick with me. I promise it's going to seem really random, but I also promise at the end we'll tie it all together. So having said all that, here goes. I never even told y'all what we're reading, did I? 2 Kings 5, which I'm sure you guys are all reading in your daily Bible studies right now. 2 Kings 5, that is what we're reading. I'll give you a second. That's my fault. Okay, you've had time. 2 Kings 5, chapter 5, verse 1 through 19. And we're going to read sections and stop and talk and read some more and stop and talk. So verses 1 through 3. Naaman was a general of the army under the king of Aram. He was important to his master, who held him in the highest esteem, because it was by him that God had given victory to Aram. A truly great man, but afflicted with a grievous skin disease. That skin disease is leprosy in a lot of versions, just so you know, kind of a big deal. Verse 2, it so happened that Aram, on one of its raiding expeditions against Israel, captured a young girl who became a maid to Naaman's wife. One day she said to her mistress, "Oh, if only our master could meet the prophet of Samaria, he would be healed of his skin disease." Okay, a lot of names, a lot of places thrown in there. Really brief recap. Naaman, he's a general of an army of a country called Aram, I don't know. We're just going to call it Aram. I may even say it different here now. But Aram is what is current-day Syria, if you like geography. That's what we're talking about. He's a great, great general, wins a lot of wars for his master, the king, but he also has leprosy. In this day, leprosy, well, it's no good now either, but if you had leprosy in this day, it almost unfortunately reflected on your character. You're suddenly a lesser human being if you had this big skin disease. We won't go into why, because I don't know why, but it is that way. But he had that, but he was also a great man, so you get this conflict already setting up, right? And in one of this guy's big raids, they go into Israel, and in this story, they're currently invading Israel, which is what makes this story really weird as we go into it, but it's funny. They capture this one girl. She becomes Naaman, the general's wife. She becomes his wife's maid, right? And she's an Israelite, so she's familiar with the God of Israel. And she says to Naaman's wife, if Naaman would simply go to Israel, there's a prophet there that can heal him. So that's kind of what's going on here, right? Which is kind of mature on that girl's part. I'm just going to be honest, if I was captured by a foreign army, nothing in me is wanting to help them at that point. If he's got leprosy, I hope it gets worse, is where I would stand there, but she's better than I am. Verse 4, Naaman went straight to his master and reported what the girl from Israel had said. Well then, the king of Aram said, well then go, said the king of Aram, and I'll send a letter of introduction to the king of Israel. So he went off, taking with him about 750 pounds of silver, 150 pounds of gold, and 10 sets of clothes. Verse 6, Naaman delivered the letter to the king of Israel. The letter said, when you get this letter, you'll know that I've personally sent my servant Naaman to you. Heal him of his skin disease. Okay, so there's some ridiculous irony already setting up here. Aram, this land that Naaman is a general for, is currently invading and raiding Israel. Yet he's sending this letter to a prophet of Israel, or to the king of Israel first, saying, hey, can you guys heal me of my leprosy as I'm invading your nation? Which is obviously quite ridiculous, and we'll move into that, but that matters as the story goes on. Verse 7, when the king of Israel read the letter, he was terribly upset, ripping his robe to pieces. He said, am I a god with the power to bring death or life that I get orders to heal this man from his disease? What's going on here? That king's trying to pick a fight. That's what, like you do, right, when someone asks you to pray for him, you just kind of flip out and tear your clothes and ask if they're trying to start a fight. You get it. That's obviously kind of like, hey man, chill a little bit, but it obviously makes a little more sense because these same people are invading his land and capturing his people. Weird story, I'm telling you. Verse 8, Elisha, the man of God, heard what had happened, that the king of Israel was so distressed that he'd ripped his robe to shreds. He sent word to the king, why are you so upset, ripping your robe like this? Send him to me so he'll learn that there's a prophet in Israel. I like Elisha right here. I relate to Elisha in no other way than this. He's just kind of like, dude, chill a little bit. He's just asking for some prayer, right? So he's like, send him to me. I'll take care of him. So verse 9. So Naaman with his horses and chariots arrived in style and stopped at Elisha's door. Horses and chariots in this day are all the instruments and makings of war and invasion, of high-class sorts of people. Not everyone's riding around on horses and chariots these days. So you get this humble prophet Elisha living wherever humble prophets live at this point in time, and you get this king from, or not this king, but this general from another land show up with all his tanks and fighter jets and aircraft carriers and whatnot at your front door. So you'd think that'd be a pretty big deal. Verse 10, so Elisha sends out a servant to meet him with his message, which is funny in and of itself. He's like, you go get that. He sends a message. It says, go to the River Jordan and immerse yourself 7 times. Your skin will be healed and you'll be as good as new. So not only does he not even go out to meet the guy, he doesn't like send a servant to like make sure it's all safe. He just tells a servant to tell him to go to the river and bathe. Like, yeah, don't I got nothing for you. Just go to the river, right? So he does that. If you see me flipping pages, I'm the only human being on earth that still uses paper. It's like that. I like it. I don't like technology. But anyway, I hope that doesn't weird you out. You've probably never seen somebody on stage use a piece of paper, but I am. Verse 11 through 12, at this, so we remember that he just got sent to a river, doesn't even meet the prophet. Verse 11 and 12, Naaman lost his temper. He turned on his heel saying, I thought he'd at least personally come out and meet me, call in the name of God, wave his hand over the disease spot, and get rid of the disease. You get the picture there. He's wanting some big, like, big moment. Verse 12, the Damascus rivers, Abana and Pharpar, are cleaner by far than any of the rivers of Israel. Why not bathe in them? At least I'd get clean. He stomped off, mad as a hornet. Side note, I wish he would not have put mad as a hornet in the message right there. That's so weird to me. But he did, so I read it. But we get the idea here, right? Prophet sends him to some dirty river in Israel no one's ever heard of. It's called the Jordan. He's like, just go bathe in that seven times. All is well. And he's like, man, I got better rivers than that where I come from, which is kind of a funny argument to get in, whose river is better, but that's what they're doing. Verse 13, but his servants caught up with him and said, and at this point forward, this is where I think it starts to become applicable to us. If you don't see it yet, that's fine. I will explain it at the end. I promise you I'll tie all this together. Just bear with me. Verse 13, but his servants caught up with him and said, Father, if the prophet had asked you something or asked you to do something hard and heroic, wouldn't you have done it? So why not this simple wash and be clean? Here's where I think we begin to start relating to this, right? Something's wrong. We want something from God. We're praying. I mean, we want to see a miracle, dang it. You know, like, I want to see something cool. Like, stuff is bad. I want to see something good immediately. And not only do I just want to go off by myself to a river, but I want a lot of people praying for me. I want some guy to come out. I want some big, powerful preacher to come out and do this. And that's not how it's going down for him, right? And his guys around him kind of call him on that. They're like, look, man, he's telling you what to do, and it's easy. So just do it, right? Like, I don't know what you're trying to make so hard about this. So verse 14, so he did it. He went down and immersed himself in the Jordan seven times, following the orders of the holy man. His skin was healed. It was like the skin of a little baby. He was good as new. So we see what happened here. Any of you guys ever seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Okay, the scene where they're like, three guys are in the woods talking. They're running from everyone. And all these, like, saints start walking by in the woods, and they're all singing, and they're going down to the river to be baptized. This is instantly what came to mind on here, just because I love that movie, for one. If you haven't seen it, I'm sorry. You should go watch it. I would recommend it. But, like, these three guys who are just truly idiots. I mean, that's their character. They go down to this river, and one of the guys is, like, this super intellectual guy, and he's making fun of everyone else, and two of his friends go down there. They're all crooks, and he comes out, he's like, I've been washed in the blood and all this. And he's like, he knows nothing about following Christ at all, except he's been washed and the holy man made him clean. To me, it's the exact same thing here. Again, if you haven't seen it, it's hilarious. Go watch it. Anyway, verse 15. He then went back to the holy man. He and his entourage stood before him and said, I now know beyond a shadow of a doubt that there is no God anywhere on earth other than the God of Israel. In gratitude, let me give you a gift. That expression that he makes there in this time is huge. At this day and age, not this day and age, in that day and age, that was not the idea that there was one God. To these people, there's gods everywhere. There's a God of the soil, there's a God of the sun, God of the harvest, God of the sea, God of everything. There's a God for everything. And something about Naaman's experience at the river, he realizes that the God of Israel is the one true God. And if you don't know this, the God of Israel is the God that we serve. So this is a big deal. He's if you follow Jesus and you follow the God that we're talking about here, this guy just had the same realization that you had at some point when you decided to follow these teachings in this way of life, which is a big deal. Not everything changes at that moment, but at least mentally and at least emotionally and spiritually, stuff starts to change for you at that point. You start seeing things different. That's the moment this guy just has. He's fighting it. He doesn't want to do it. He goes down. Whatever happens, happens, and he's now a new man, essentially, right? So he comes back. He's incredibly grateful. He wants to give a gift to Elisha. Verse 16, as God lives, Elisha replied, the God whom I serve, I'll take nothing from you. Naaman tried his best to get him to take something, but he wouldn't do it. Verse 17 and 18, so this is where it starts to get really interesting to me. So this guy is now... He's not, okay, I'm going to use this term so we can relate to it because not much has changed. I'm going to call him a Christian. I get he's not a Christian. Christ doesn't come for a long time after that. I'm aware of this. But we're going to use that term so that we can relate to this story, because it doesn't change, I promise you, the thoughts presented here. He's Jewish, if we want to call it that. Not Jewish by culture. He's Jewish by religion, right? He's from a pagan land. And if you don't care about all that, that's fine. It's not a huge deal here. All you got to understand is that he believes in the same God that you believe in at this point. Verse 17. If you won't take anything, said Naaman, let me ask you for something. And he asked two things here. First, give me a load of dirt, as much as a team of donkeys can carry, because I'm never again going to worship any god other than God. So that's the first thing he asked. He asked for that because in this day and time, the gods are highly tied in a non-physical sense, in a spiritual sense, in their minds. The gods are tied to the soil of a land. Maybe because they're agricultural people, I don't know. But they often thought that the gods existed in the soil. So this guy's like, man, at least let me take some soil from here and bring it back so that I've got, I don't know what he's looking for, a representation, a remembrance. Maybe he's going to build an altar with it. I don't know. But he's asking for the soil because that's where the gods live in his mind. We know that is not true, right? We know that God is everywhere in all things, all these sorts of things. So one, he's already missing that. He doesn't get it. There's a lot of stuff he doesn't get, right? I hope that is much like me and you. We often are very educated people when it comes to our religion, but often that is somewhat useless because it's quite simple, really, and I think oftentimes we skip over the basics, but we'll get there, jumping ahead. So that's his first request. Verse 18, but there's one thing for which I need God's pardon, and here's where it gets a little crazy, and you may disagree, but it's in the Bible, and I don't know what to tell you about that. But there's one thing for which I need God's pardon. When my master, leaning on my arm, enters the shrine of Ramon and worships there, and I'm there with him, worshiping Ramon, may you see to it that God forgive me for this. We're going to stop right there. That's kind of a crazy thing when we think about it, right? You know, if I'm a new believer, been in this for about 6 hours now, and I go to Pastor Chris and I'm like, hey man, just so you know, I'm probably going to have to go bow down to another god. That's probably not the response you're going to get from Chris or anyone. I wouldn't give that response, generally speaking. And again, I think we'll get into why he gives him this response that he gets, but I haven't even given you the response yet unless you read ahead. I'm jumping ahead because this is where I get excited, so I might have jumbled that. Anyway, he's essentially asking for forgiveness because he's going to have to go worship another god. When he says worship another god, he's not talking about heart worship here. He's talking about a physical act. He's going to have to go and bow down because his master will be leaning on him. But in the verse before, he literally says, because I'm never again going to worship any other god than God. So this guy gets that worship now is focused on the God of Israel. He may have to do some stuff that doesn't look right, but he's like 6 hours into this. I don't know how long it takes to go from the Jordan to where Elisha was, but he's pretty new at this. Finally, verse 19, he asked him to forgive him for that. Elisha said, everything will be all right. Go in peace. Not the answer you would typically expect or give. So I hope you understand that story. That's all the Bible we're going to read. That sounds weird, but that's all the reading we're going to do. The rest will be me talking, so congratulations. So there's three main thoughts that I want to take from this. One's a question. They're kind of broad thoughts, and me and Chris differ in teaching style on this. He's usually got some super exact points that you can like actually take from here and really apply, which is awesome. I typically think a little more, I don't want to necessarily say abstract. I don't necessarily think in like super bullet point like that, but I tried to come up with three to make it clear because it's such a weird story. So we'll go through those. And what I'd ask of you is just to consider yourself in your current life and what this would mean to you. And I'm not going to tell you how to apply it directly because we're all intelligent people and I think it's better to think about it yourself. But I would ask you to stay with me and think about it. So the first point is more of a question. And my question is, did Elisha get it wrong here? Because I think that's a fair question. Did he miss the point? He tells the guy everything's going to be okay, go in peace. When the guy just told him, I'm going to have to go down into a pagan god's temple and bow down. I would think Elisha would have said something along the lines of, no, you better get prayed up and go out there in victory and win the lost, right? You better go and represent the God that you now see and all these sorts of things. And he doesn't say that at all. He says, it's okay, go in peace. So what do we take from that? Because we can't ignore it. It's there. I don't care what version you read. It reads pretty much just like that. And so you can either choose to ignore it and move on and not challenge yourself, or you can choose to read that, think about it, and figure out what it may or may not mean. I choose the latter. Why is it that Elisha, a man of God, a spokesman for God, a prophet, why is it that he's okay with this behavior? We all know that sin is sin. He's not excusing sin. He's not saying, yeah, go do whatever you want. I think we have to assume that's not what he's saying. Here's what I think he's saying, and this is opinion. It's perfectly fair to disagree. Like I said, just think about it. That's all I'm asking you to do. I'm giving you my thoughts. I think often, and we've said this before at this church, this is not my original idea, but I love this thought, and I think it's incredibly important, and I think it relates to this story. Often, we try to make people behave before they will belong, right? And that is incredibly tragic to me. I think that goes against the ways of Jesus. I think that goes against the ways of Elisha. It goes against the ways of a lot of things. And I think it comes down to the heart, obviously. I mean, there is such a thing as right and wrong behavior. I'm not saying anything goes. Don't hear me say that. But I'm saying there's also a growth period, right? And this guy's just barely figured it out. He still thinks God is in the dirt, right? He's wanting to load up his donkeys with dirt to take back. Like, this guy just barely gets it, right? And I don't think we're that much different. Maybe we know a lot more, but I don't think our level of obedience is so much further than his is, right? He's got an incredible heart, actually. He's been in this for less than a day, and he's already realizing some things that are probably going to have to change at some point. I guess the way we express this at Motion is we want Motion to be a place where people can belong before they believe, right? Whether you believe or not is not my responsibility. Essentially, it's not my problem. Right? I want to set you up for success with that. I want to point you to the God that I think is awesome, the God of Israel, the God of the one and true God. Obviously, I'm living that way. I mean, not obviously, I'm living that way, but obviously, I've chosen to try to live that way. Obviously, I like it. Of course, I'd try to point people towards that. But whether they believe or not is not my responsibility. If somebody walks in this door as an unbeliever, not my problem, really. I can't make them believe anything. But if they start asking questions, or maybe they start realizing something that may change in their life, yeah, I'll talk to them. But if I've got 30 minutes with somebody, or however long this interaction is, I'm going to have to preach some very basic stuff to this person, right? You don't want to make it complicated. And so Elisha, let me make sure I'm not jumping ahead. I often do that. That's why I've got paper. I'm going to back up for just a second. That's what the paper's for. When you think about the gospel, right, the good news, whatever sort of good news the God of Israel brings, this guy Naaman just realized it. I don't know what it looks like for him. But wouldn't you agree that in many ways the gospel is bigger than words can express? If you read, I mean, just read the New Testament, just read the gospels. Jesus communicates it really well. But if you kind of look back objectively and look at it, he's trying pretty hard. He speaks in parables. He speaks in stories. He's always comparing the kingdom of God to this, these things that they relate to, because it's a big, lofty, grand idea when you're talking about God. Side point, have you ever even thought about what you're talking about when you say God? Like, what do we mean when we say God? I mean, you can make this as deep as you possibly want to. And Naaman, or Elisha, who's very wise here, it's not going that way. He's not worried about that. He wants this guy to know that the God of Israel is a God of love and a God of acceptance and these sorts of things, and that he's not angry with him. Like, of course he's new at this, but so what? You know, I mean, we all pretty much are. I mean, even if you've been doing this for 40 years. Okay, so it's 40 years. Like, you figured God out? No, you haven't. Like, and that's okay to not have God figured out. If you could have God figured out, then that'd be kind of boring. I mean, you'd be equivalent to God if you had them all figured out. And that would not be cool. The phrase, preach the gospel at all times, and if necessary, use words, I think applies here. You guys ever heard that? I think that's incredibly powerful. Because here's the thing. At least the young generation, and I think even older generations, I don't know if I can even include myself in the young generation anymore. Is 33 still the young generation? Yeah? Sweet. Then my generation, I was hoping someone would say that, the young generation, I'm trying to say this nicely, our bullcrap meter is pretty sensitive, right? Would you agree with that? We know when someone's just giving lip service. We know when somebody's just saying stuff and when somebody really lives what they're saying. We've seen it in marketing. We've seen it everywhere. And we're pretty sensitive to that. We get it. Like, if you're just talking a big game, you're just wasting your time and you're probably doing more harm than good. And I think Elisha sees this in a sense. Now, I'm adding to this story a little bit, but I think this matters. I guess generally I'm talking about how do we relate to the outsiders, right? The non-believers, whatever you want to call people, right? That they don't live the way we live. So what? How do we approach that? I think Elisha gives us some very interesting insight into that. It's really not that complicated anyway when it comes down to it. I mean, Jesus was asked what was important. In a sense, I mean, he was asked, you know, what's the greatest commandment? In paraphrasing, we've heard this before, but I hope we never forget it because it's vitally important, is to love God and to love people. And I think when Elisha responds the way he does to Naaman here, saying everything will be all right, go in peace, that phrase communicates everything there is to know about the way the Father views us and the way we should view those that don't feel the way we feel. That one, God is bigger than any of this. Not that discipleship is out of the picture. I love discipleship. I love teaching and all these sorts of things. I get it. But if you got half a day with somebody and you got to communicate something and they're just now getting it, just let them go in peace, right? That's what we should do. I think we need to use incredible tact and a lot of wisdom when communicating the gospel because it's the most important message ever, 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 right? I think outsiders should leave our presence knowing that God is love, and that new believers should leave our presence knowing that they're at peace with God. No, they're not where they need to be, but neither are you. So what's it matter? I mean, yeah, obviously I'm not saying don't call someone sin. I'm not saying that. But there's a time and a place for every sort of conversation within the faith. So did Elisha miss it? I say no. I think Elisha nailed it. And I think he used a lot of wisdom in his response. So that's the first point, more of a question. Did Elisha miss his opportunity? No, he did not. Point two, it is not hard to come to God. And the come to God here, I'm not saying as a new believer. I'm saying if you consider yourself a follower of Jesus, we have to understand that it is not hard to come to God. It's not complicated to come to God. We make things way too difficult sometimes. We want to learn way too much before we experience enough. We want to learn way too much before we're obedient enough. Learning's cool. We're part of a society that likes education. We value it. I love education. I promise you I do. I like learning. If you can't already tell, I'm quite a nerd, and I like to learn a lot of stuff. I'm not saying don't learn things. But when it comes to your faith, what you know is far less important than what you've experienced and what you do with what you already do know. This is where I'm... Okay, you guys are just going to have to trust me here. It's going to sound possibly like I am bashing prayer right now. I am not, okay? I'm simply giving you a sort of thought, okay? So just don't be super quick to be like, I don't know. Like, just hear me out, okay? Hear me out. I don't think we always need a huge prayer service to see God work, okay? One, this story kind of proves that, so I've got that working for me anyway. I think oftentimes we are too much like Naaman for our own good, in that we need something from God and we refuse to accept it unless it comes in the exact way that we want it to, usually meaning just a full-on, out-of-the-blue, fall-from-the-sky miracle. Like, I've got a cold, and there's some cold medicine right there that will make me feel 100% better, but I don't want that. I want to pray and instantly feel better. I'm with you, man. That'd be freaking awesome. But it doesn't happen very often, right? And so if that's the case, could I not just thank God that there's some medicine right here that I could get a drink and swallow a pill and all is well with my soul at that point, you know? Like, you get where I'm going with this? I'm not saying don't pray at all. But maybe there's things worth praying more for than that. That's a dangerous statement. That can get me in trouble. I'm going to stop balancing here in a moment. But I don't want to be careless with my words, for one. But I want to be very honest and very real about how things actually happen in our lives. Maybe it's your own fault. I don't know. Not my place to make that call. That's not where I'm going this morning. Naaman was offered a simple solution. Go down to this dirty little river in Israel, jump in it 7 times, and you're good to go. He doesn't want it, you know? It's almost like, well, I don't want the medicine, I want God. I mean, do they have to be separate? I mean, is the medicine truly opposite of God? Why is that? I mean, I get what you're saying, but why does it have to be that way, you know? And the medicine is an example. I think we see this in a lot of areas in our lives. We pray about money all the time, like, oh, God, my finances are so tight, you know? And I should not have even gone to finances. Finances are a passion of mine. You could spend less and save more, possibly, and loosen up some finances. and not make God have to pull off some great miracle so you can keep spinning like crazy, right? Just a thought. Their prayer is good, but don't pray for more money. Pray for more wisdom. Pray for more self-control. Pray for less greed, more contentment, all these sorts of things, right? I have not met anyone in America yet who does not have enough money. They may not have enough money for what they want to do all the time. There's a lot of money going around. And even if you don't have a lot of money or you don't have the money you need, it's pretty easy to go get it. And I'm speaking generally. I know there's exceptions, but I'm pointing at you. I just realized that. I don't mean to do that. That gets me fired up. I'm going to stop. You get the point. Anyway, and so what about these times? And this is kind of a side thought, but this is something I think as Christians we would be healthy and good to at least consider the implications of. Have you ever prayed for something and nothing happened? Anyone? Yes. Oftentimes that's terrifying, right? Well, man, what does that say about the God that I serve? What does that say about me? Does God even exist? Do I even exist to God? Does he care? Is he there? All these sorts of thoughts that we get, right? Again, this is a little off the point, but this is kind of a passion of mine. Like, don't relate your well-being to God and how he feels about you to whether or not a prayer is answered. Because if we're honest this morning, prayer is incredibly mysterious, right? I mean, it's a simple act in that you're just petitioning God for something, but it works really weird. I mean, maybe this is on me, but just completely honestly, like, I've had very few prayers answered the way I thought they would be answered. I don't even know if they were answered at all. But here I am, right? Alive and well. So at some point, everything works out. Chris says it all the time. Everything's going to work out. It always does, right? And that's the truth. Now, the benefit of prayer here, you're showing God that you trust him. True. That's good. Prayer is often, I think, like a counseling session. It's often good to go to a counselor and just kind of spit it all out. Like, here's what I'm stressed about. God's the greatest counselor you'll ever have. But he's not a genie in a bottle. He's not some rich guy in the sky who's ready to throw finances at every one of your problems. He's not a witch doctor who's going to offer you an instant cure to every sickness. Because more than the healing and more than the answer to the prayer, the more valuable gain here, I think, is the adversity in and of itself, right? Without adversity, without trials, without these sorts of things, there is no endurance, there is no strength, there is no maturity, there's no need for it. I don't have a point there. That's my point. We're smart people. I don't like to make ultimate points. These are kind of abstract thoughts that we all know are true. We all experience these things. I don't have the answer to that, but I know for sure if you're a human being in this room and you've ever contemplated God, you've contemplated one of these thoughts before, and sometimes they're scary, and sometimes we move on, and sometimes that's okay. Sometimes we need to address them and just get them out there. So, in light of that, I think we need a place where we can go to meet with God personally. That's really what we want. That's ultimately what healed Naaman here. I think even if Naaman didn't get healed, but he went to the river and experienced God somehow, all is well with Naaman at that point. I think about this with myself a lot. Church is cool. I love church. I love coming to church. I've got a lot of friends here. There's a lot of growth that comes to church. When I experience God, I'm outside. I wish a prophet would tell me to just go to the river for a while. That'd be sweet. If somebody was just like, hey, man, you need to go out into the woods. You would not see me for a long time. I like the woods. I mean, I've got a picture in my mind right now of a river going through the woods, and I'm sitting there, and I promise you God is there with me in the dirt, in the woods. I'm with Naaman on this one, man. But you guys get the point there, right? What about in people, right? I think oftentimes we want to hear God speak to us. This is, again, not a new idea, but I think it's worth remembering and being reminded of. God speaks to us through people all the friggin' time, right? All the time. People are answers to prayers. I mean, I don't understand the way it works. I truly don't. You're probably getting that loud and clear at this point. I don't understand prayer. I get that it's good and necessary. I do understand that when things are hard, people often are the help that I've been needing. And when people are not the help that I've been needing, if I can go somewhere to experience God, whatever that looks like, and I can leave that place and go in peace because I just experienced God, that's what I needed. Circumstances may not have changed at all. They could be worse. But at that point, I know all is well with my soul and life will go on. And that's ultimately what we need, right? So my takeaway for that one, and that it's not hard to come to God. For one, keep it simple for yourself. Please don't overcomplicate it. It does nothing good for you. Don't focus on the flashy stuff. Just do what you know works and move on. Get alone and experience God. And if prayers aren't answered the way you want, that's okay. It's okay. Sometimes they don't get answered at all. I don't know why, but we've got to be okay with that. And we've got to move on and go in peace, right? Because it's going to work out. So point two is it's not hard to come to God. Point three, the final point. So if I've completely lost you the whole time, we're almost done. Hopefully that's not where we're at. The final point is I want to focus on this phrase, go in peace. I love that phrase. I think it's because probably I don't have a lot of peace a lot of times. My mind is always going. I want to solve problems. I find problems, probably more problems than I should. I see them. I want to fix them. I see things in society that drive me nuts, and I can't stop thinking about them. I worry. You guys get it. I'm not alone in that. But that phrase, go in peace, is an incredibly powerful phrase. And the main place I want to take this is our standing with God. It is not an uncommon, and I know there's people in this room that feel this way, that we constantly worry about whether or not we're right with God. And I think we need to cut it out with that worry. This phrase that gets thrown around, I'm just a sinner saved by grace, is true at one point in your life. Dang it, I pointed again. I think I was doing the one point, not a point, but one. I don't think if you've come to Christ, you can truly identify yourself as a sinner. Yes, you do sin, but that is not your identity, right? I love mountain biking. I like fishing. I like hunting. My identity is not fisherman or hunter or bicyclist or whatever, right? My identity is far more than that. Your identity is far, far, far more bigger and better than what you do, right? And we have to realize that. That is not to say what you do is always okay. Oftentimes it may be very bad, but that is not your identity. Your identity at this point is a child of God. And if you're Naaman, at this point your identity is barely child of God, but nonetheless you're a child of God. We have to understand that the cross of Christ was a final, 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 final work. It happened and it's done, right? You can't just continually have this go over and over. If it wasn't the final work, then it was a complete waste of time because it happened and it's done and it's not continually happening. And so to continually beat yourself up over the things you do at this point is to say that the work of Christ on the cross was worthless, waste of time, wasn't big enough for me. Everyone else, that's fine, but I still mess up, therefore I'm not right with God. The cross was not big enough for me. That is one of the most blasphemous mentalities I think you could ever have. And I don't mean that to be mean, but we throw around a lot of things that, oh, that's evil, that's bad, blah, blah, blah. Like, to say that you follow Christ, but to continually beat yourself up over the things you do wrong, I think throws the work of the cross in the mud continually over and over and over again. And I say that to say that there is a ton of freedom in that. I don't say anything goes, sin, doesn't matter. The work of the cross covers it all. It does cover it all, but as far as you're standing with God, you're good to go. Keep moving forward. The phrase we have here a lot is, you know, God loves you right where you're at, but he loves you way too much to keep you there. Fully agree, but you are where you are, right? And I'm saying this to those of us who are trying. If you're just not trying, then that in and of itself is an issue. But for those of us that are trying to serve and love God and love people and all these things, and we know that we screw up all the time, it's okay. All is well. It's all going to be okay. We can go in peace, right? So Naaman says he's going to have to go and bow down in this temple. We often bow down in our own lives. What does this mean for us to bow down? Often we don't act like we should. Often we know we act like we know we shouldn't. Often we do the things we don't want to do. We don't do the things we do want to do. Just like Paul, just like Naaman, just like us, right? That's how it goes down. We have to be okay, if you're trying. We have to be okay with the idea that we're all becoming more like Christ. We're becoming that. It's a continual, perpetual sort of thing. But we're not there yet. And even further, we must be okay with the fact that God is okay with that, right? He loves that you're trying. He loves that you're moving forward. Obviously, he doesn't like sin, but that's the whole idea. You're not going to be sinless. If you're sinless, you're Christ, and you're not. So get over it, right? Like, you're going to screw up. You're going to bow down to something. And God is, in a sense, okay with that, right? Because it's not about the perfection. It's about the pursuit, right? It's about the cross. It's about all these sorts of things. And the pursuit is what it's about. Don't just say, well, I'm not perfect, and then keep doing things. Because you got to be pursuing, right? That matters. So for this last one, I'm closing kind of right now. Here's my main point. Some of us in this room, me included a lot of times, we're incredibly weary, we're worn, we're broken, because we know we're not living up to the high calling that we're called to live. And that's exhausting sometimes. It's overwhelming. But that's the whole point. If you're exhausted, you're doing it right. If you're trying that hard, you're doing it right, in my opinion. As long as you realize that you're not there yet, but you're earnestly trying every day to do the right thing, you're doing the right thing. Keep going. Because tomorrow, I promise you, you're going to screw up. I don't mean to speak that over you. You're going to. And if you make it through tomorrow, then it'll be the next day. But you're going to. And it doesn't change your standing with God at all. At all. Some of us are struggling with habitual sin. Some of us are fighting depression. I do all the time. Depression is my biggest downfall. I hate it, but it's there. Does God hate me? Am I lesser because I'm not so happy as some people? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Some of us are arrogant. Some of us are just plain old guilty. Some of us are addicted to pornography. We're full of lust, full of sexual sin. Some of us are greedy, sad, hurt, addicted to alcohol, broken, lack of trust. All the list could go on, right? But you've got to know that it's okay. You have to know that it's okay. If you fit in that list somewhere, I think God says to you, all is well with your soul. Just keep on keeping on, right? To those of us who fit somewhere on that list, I think God says, go in peace. See, this is ultimately a story of hope. Naaman understood that he was returning to his land, a man who needed forgiveness. Elisha understood that Naaman was returning to his land, a forgiven man. We must understand this about ourselves. Just like with Naaman, we will bow down to something, probably daily, if not more than that. The great hope that we have is that all is well with our soul. It doesn't mean that we're living how we should be. Even the best of us in this room are really no better off than Naaman, though we may know more about God. So to all who are fighting, to all who are trying, to all who are leaving here and going to a place where we just might, in a weak moment, bow down, I think God says to all of us, go in peace. That's all I've got. Let's pray. Father, I thank you a lot that all is well with our soul. I don't say that comfortably. I don't say that pridefully. I recognize that fact, and I thank you for it. I pray that you would keep us from making it overly complicated when we approach those who don't see things the way we do. I pray that you could allow us to preach your gospel, the greatest message ever, that you would allow us to communicate that as clearly and as lovingly as possible. I pray that you would give us the discipline and the wisdom to understand that coming to you is a simple act because of the cross. The sacrifice has been made, the price has been paid, we're well with you. And finally, I pray for all of us who are tired and are weary and are broken and have been fighting the good fight and are exhausted from fighting the good fight, that you'd give us the strength and the wisdom to keep on keeping on, because ultimately that's all we can do. For all of us, I pray that you would truly allow us to understand that we can leave here and go in peace. In your name, amen.